People assume I do this podcast because I have aspirations to transition into the world of broadcasting, or I want my own radio show on terrestrial or satellite radio, or I have some ulterior scheme up my sleeve. Nothing can be further from the truth. It's understandable, though. These days, people don't do things unless they have some concealed agenda, and every move is just another branch of a multitask. I've said this time and time again. My reasons for doing this podcast are nothing more than procuring extended meet and greets with people I admire. Think of it as a long, protracted fan scheme that's involved me putting out 8 studio albums of my own band in order to get to this stage. And as much as I lack patience, it's the long game that always interests me. It's a great privilege to be able to sit in a room with someone I've listened to and watched since my formative music years. And David Wilcox is one of those people. I've been listening to David Wilcox for as long as I was able to turn on my parents' radio and twist the dial to find any radio station that emitted distorted guitars. When I finally landed on local rock radio station Q107, David's songs were in heavy rotation there, long enough to eventually get woven into the fabric of my musical psyche. First, hearing David Wilcox unknowingly, and then eventually understanding who he was in grade school to eventually getting into him, he's somebody who has always been there for me. Admittedly, while growing up, I embraced and absorbed other genres into my musical palette more readily than David's, but I'd always go back and touch base with David Wilcox. I would never view his music as something I had outgrown or phased out of either. It was always a familiar voice and guitar, free of pretension, always comforting, always warm. I'd always end a reconnection to David's music with me saying to myself, I forgot how good his music was. I've probably said that to myself almost a dozen times throughout the years. He's been putting out solo albums since 1978, when he released Out of the Woods, followed by My Eyes Keep Me in Trouble, Bad Reputation, and then Breakfast at the Circus. Those records kicked off an impressive string of hits that have since been embedded into the psyche of a whole generation of music fans, myself included. I put songs like Do the Bearcat, That Hypnotizing Boogie, Bad Apple, Downtown Came Uptown, Too Cool, Riverboat Fantasy, Layin' Pipe, Honor Roll, Preachin' the Blues, and Hot Hot Papa on the same playlist and equal footing with classic rock staples like Robert Cray, George Thorogood, Bonnie Raitt, The Fabulous Thunderbirds, Keb Moe, and ZZ Top. Murray McLaughlin once called David Wilcox an eccentric songwriter. That's one way to look at it. I'd choose other adjectives simply because eccentric suggests weird or odd, but doesn't necessarily connote catchy, memorable, appealing, and singable. All components that make up a gifted songwriter, all components that make up David Wilcox. I only point this out because I feel he's often underrated and overlooked, or maybe I've put him on such an elevated perch. And then there's the business of his status as guitar hero, something which is very correctly designated, but sometimes when listing guitar heroes in this country, names like Alex Lifeson, Jeff Healey, Pat Travers, Rick Emmett, Paul Dean, Gordy Johnson, Ian Thornley, and Denny DeMore might overtake the spotlight, but make no mistake, David Wilcox belongs on that list too. Dare I say heads above a few of those exalted names I just mentioned. I met David Wilcox twice before this podcast episode get together, and I walked away contented that my image I had of the man did not diminish, but rather maintained and grew. So with that, and my fandom intact, I felt confident enough to try and secure a sit-down, confident that I could hurl questions about his career, and he wouldn't back down. My timing couldn't have been worse, though. Seems that David played a New Year's Eve show last December and was now in the first quarter of a year-long sabbatical from shows, from appearances, and from doing interviews. However, he made an exception to do this podcast, coming out of his sabbatical to meet me and endure a lifelong David Wilcox fanboy out on him. For that, I am grateful, flattered, and consider it a feather in my cap. None of this would have been possible if it weren't for Jane Harbury, David's publicist, who hooked this meeting up and provided the space for us to do it. So thank you very much, Jane. I must state here that 30 to 35 minutes into my talk with David, I had some technical problems that I didn't quite catch until 15 minutes after it happened, and because of that, I lost about 15 minutes of our discussion. I had to do the rest of the podcast through my smartphone, but I do think the audio is totally fine. Actually, it's almost on par, so, you know, go figure. This podcast is supported by Blue Mic Microphones, Skull Candy Headphones. This podcast supports Chino Loco's restaurants because when I want a fish burrito, I want it stuffed with chow mein noodles. Thanks for listening to the podcast. And if you can, please leave a rating and or a review in the iTunes store. It helps the podcast's profile. Okay, here we go. This is my talk with the guitar hero, the bluesman, the Canadian music icon, David Wilcox. And it starts now. The Daniel Jones podcast is the best around. Nick Flynn and Guinness Dickens go out to love for free. I'm so glad I like to sometimes tear me in from fucked up. Stop playing hang down, down. Daniel Jones podcast with a finger on the pulse of what's going on culturally in the world. Wait a second. That's not his finger.
When the weather is bad and there's nothing much to do, take a listen, would you now, to what Danko Jones would do. It's the middle of the night and you better do it fast. Turn the speakers up loud for Danko's podcast.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, get ready because the Danko Jones podcast starts. No!
David, it is a pleasure, an honor to have you on my podcast today. I've been looking forward to this for a very long time.
Thank you, Danko. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
The first time we met, and I don't know if you remember, because people always say this to you, you come, hey, remember me? I'm the guy who said, go for it, 7 years ago during the show on the Encore.
I fixed your shoe. I think I remember because I know, I mean, I know your distinction as a musician, so it makes a person stand out a bit. When, you know.
Well, it was Hamilton.
Was it? I didn't know where it was.
Yeah, but, okay. It was Hamilton in the catering of this, I guess it was an indoor kind of festival thing we were playing, and you were there with Rick Emmett.
Yeah, that's right. It's a songwriter's circle I was in, I think. And Ian Thomas was there too, I think.
And we were in some other part of the venue in Hamilton, big arena, but we were playing a separate show. Mm-hmm. But there was all kinds of music things going on in the building.
Sure.
And I went up to Rick Emmett. I didn't see you at first. And then I turned and I saw you, and I can't remember if it was you or I went up to you, and that's how I met you. And of course, I mean, I know your music. It was it cemented that moment for me when I met you. It was amazing.
Cool.
It was right after catering. And I just thought to myself, damn. If we had only come in here 20 minutes earlier, we could have had dinner with David Wilcox and Rick Emmett. Well. and then I saw you a few years back on the subway.
Yes, we did. I remember that too.
That I remember, and what I remember about it was you had just come from Ottawa.
Oh, was that right after the shooting in Ottawa?
Yeah, I
know. My wife and I like to go away for weekends and not go far. You know, just a simple get out of town.
Yeah.
And we went to Ottawa and went for a walk. And all of a sudden, there were police everywhere and we couldn't go back to our hotel. And there were all kinds of rumors, you know. And it was really an unusual experience. And I eventually booked us another hotel because I thought, and I didn't have my passport with me, which is kind of scary.
Yeah.
You know, we did get in. We were at the Chateau Laurier.
Yeah.
And that was in the center of the tragedy, you know.
Yeah.
So it all resolved fairly well, but it was a little more than we'd planned for.
I mean, in Canadian terms, that was a very big event. I mean, in terms of guns and shooting and stuff. We don't get those things too often around here. So you were kind of in the heart of it, and it had just happened.
Yes. Well, I'm a big fan of multiculturalism, yeah. And I think that the more we include people and let people feel, or everybody feel, that we have a voice, the less likely it is that those kind of things are going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, you know? Absolutely. I think you were still a little bit shocked by it.
I was very shocked by it.
Because that was the first thing you went into on our brief subway ride.
Yeah, I'm sure I was still processing it, yeah.
I think it took about two stops for me to approach you.
Oh.
And I spotted you. I'm like, oh my God, that's David Wilcox.
Hmm.
I think I got an in with him from Hamilton.
Oh, well, I mean, like I said, I know who you are and your music. So,
I think, you know, when I hear you, when I hear your music, I hear your voice, the immediate thing that hits me is it is such a comforting voice for me because I've grown up with it. You were, and I was thinking back leading up to this interview, you were most likely the first I heard the blues in a proper context.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm not the only one, is, you know, in these parts that could say that.
Mm-hmm.
But the most distinct memory I have is when I was in grade 8,
mm-hmm.
and we were all into the cool bands were Van Halen and Motley Crue.
Sure.
And I remember Wasp, mm-hmm. because there was one guy who was into this band Wasp. Now, Wasp were a band that had their height of fame in the 80s. The singer ate raw meat. They sang. They had he had a saw blade on his jock strap.
Oh.
Blackie Lawless.
he stole that from me. Anyway, sorry. Go ahead.
And the guy who sat in front of me was into Wasp, and I liked Wasp too.
Mm-hmm.
Then one day, he said to me, "I'm not into any of that. I'm into David Wilcox."
Hmm.
And I said, "Who the hell is David Wilcox? Mm-hmm. That doesn't sound like Wasp or Def Leppard or Motley Crue. It's just this guy." And he brought out the cover of The Greatest Hits.
Okay.
And I was listening to Q107. I heard your voice, and I never figured out you were Caucasian. You were a white dude until, mm-hmm. I think, a couple of years later,
mm-hmm.
when Breakfast at the Circus came out. And that was the first cassette I borrowed from the public library, and that's how I got into you.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, I always wanted to tell you that because, I think I would get a kick out of it if someone goes, "How did the podcast with David Wilcox go?" And I said, "Well, we talked about Wasp."
Oh, yes. I don't think I've ever talked about Wasp before with anybody.
No.
I've heard the name, but that's it.
But that was my connection. That was my introduction to you because he did an about face, and those bands were, you know, beneath him. This was now something that was something to aspire to get into. So that's what initially got me interested and curious into you. And then I heard you on the radio, and I realized that... I really liked it. And you were great. And then I have to admit, there was years where I didn't hear you.
Mm-hmm.
But every single time I'd hear you, it was a very comforting voice. It was timeless to me and something that I always relished listening to. And leading up to this talk with you, I've obviously gone back to your records, and I stand by it.
Well, thank you.
It's fabulous. I'm a big David Wilcox fan.
Oh, thank you.
Huge. So this is a big deal for me.
All right. Well, thanks. You know, I think that a great yogi once said that music is the fastest way to bliss. And I think that anytime, and you know yourself as an artist, that anytime someone can find either comfort or release or escape or a positive feeling in one's music, that's a wonderful feeling, mm-hmm. because then you or I have been a channel for that, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know? Absolutely. And, you know, eventually doing what I ended up doing, I have there's some sort of affinity. I think we've gone through very similar paths, mm-hmm. you know, playing the kind of music we do, the style that we do. I mean, I'm just curious to hear about your experience as fronting your own music, putting mm-hmm. your name out there, mm-hmm. in this part of the world, mm-hmm. How it's been. I mean, that's mm-hmm. kind of what sure, I wanted sure. to pick your brain about.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when I started, I had been a side person. Yeah. I played with a variety of artists. Anne Murray, Ian and Sylvia for a couple of years. Different country mainly artists and some pop artists. And I eventually, with the help of my first wife, decided to step out and try being a front person because I thought it would improve my singing as a background singer, and I could solo more, which I wanted to do on the guitar because I wanted to explore that. I also had some arrangement ideas and some approach ideas, you know. And so I started doing that, never thinking that it would blossom into an ongoing career, which mm-hmm. it did. And at that time, there were a lot of little bars across Canada, but especially around the Horseshoe. I think one-third of the population of Canada lived in that Horseshoe around Lake Ontario.
Right.
So there were tons of little bars. And you could go, if you went from Richmond Hill to Oshawa, it was like going from Vienna to Melbourne, Australia. I mean, there was no overlap, really, in terms of your audience attending. And they were small places anyway. And, I mean, they weren't glamorous or anything like that. They hired, generally, bands for 3 nights to 6 nights a week. And the comms were there, which were pretty bad, usually.
Yeah.
And it didn't pay great. But you could work on your instrument. In the case of a front person, work on working with a crowd, which is an art form, as you know. Mm-hmm. And so it was a really good opportunity that way. And in the beginning, we bombed a lot because we weren't on the radio. Right. I discovered the power of airplay, which is astonishing. I mean,
it is.
It's ridiculous. You know, they must be okay. They're on the radio. You know, well, all right. But I still remember the night when it turned around. Now, we had a little following in a few places. But I got a gig in a place called Elmvale or Elmdale, Ontario, and I'd never played there before with the band, and we went, and it was a Friday night, and the place was full, which was a bad sign, because probably they'd get angry because we didn't play top 40 pop, right? And so we went on, and this is after my first album had been released, and Danko, they knew the words. They asked for our songs. It was a transforming night in my life. You know, it was so wonderful. And it took me a long time to get used to being applauded before we played. We'd have to win the audience over. You know?
Wow.
You know, so.
That is, I think people have to really take this, go back and understand the time. Because even bands that played original music were oddities. Am I right?
Very much so,
right.
Especially on that kind of circuit.
Right.
People didn't do it much, and it was frowned on. But it turned around. Again, you know, when I first started singing, people said, you don't sound like anybody else. And that was a bad thing. But then it turns into a good thing when it becomes identifiable. And people,
right.
you know, you have something of your own, hopefully.
Right, right,
you
right.
know? Yeah.
And with all these little bars and clubs, could you tour for a year? Like, could you do like 6 months to 9 months on the road, like within the province?
Maybe not within the province, but we gradually started going afield, you know, to Alberta and to Halifax. I remember the first time I went to Halifax, things like that. There was definitely enough work to keep working steadily, but again, it didn't pay well, you know. It was subsistence work, pretty much.
And these are like was it like a week stand?
Either 3 nights or a week.
Right.
You know, Monday
right.
to Wednesday or Thursday to Friday or the 6 nights. And 4 sets a night, something 3-4 sets a night, you know.
To me, this is something that I've never experienced because, mm-hmm. you know, we started our band in 96 and even yeah. before years before that,
yeah.
It was just hit the town and get out.
Yeah, it was gone by then, that kind of circuit, you know. And I think it's something of a loss, even though the places were a little, you know, cheesy and all that, you know. But the fact is that it was a chance to learn your instrument or learn one's instrument and learn how to work with an audience.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? And it's that's something that sometimes I think, you know, I look at the pattern, like great bands like the Beatles and Zeppelin, they had a repertoire in their back pocket of covers that they did years of just doing covers. It was basically college for them.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
But I jumped head first and just...
Yeah, and obviously with, you know, like little, you know, have a gift.
But it works. That's, to me, sometimes I think I would have been a stronger musician, obviously, if I had that kind of grounding. But I was just too impatient.
I don't know about stronger. You would have been probably a different musician. But the thing is, it's just apples and oranges, you know?
Right.
Yeah, yeah. That was the thing that was happening when I was coming up. And sometimes I get asked, how has the industry changed since I started working in it?
Yeah.
And I mentioned that. And the other thing I mentioned, of course, is the internet. Because the internet made it much more democratic. I'm not saying easy. I'm saying democratic in the sense that everything was run by five or six record labels. And if we all knew, or most of us working then, knew bands or artists, songwriters who were wonderful, who never got signed. So they didn't get a hearing.
Yeah.
You know, I was one of the lucky ones.
Yeah. No, I believe that the internet did. I mean, good or better or for worse, it made albums that had like $2 million marketing campaigns behind them on equal footing with someone's basement recording.
Exactly.
On certain platforms.
Yeah.
And in a way, in some cases, it was a minus, and it kind of, I think, saturated music, you know, to the point where you can't actually figure out, you can't, it's just too much that you can't find the good stuff anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just the same way that you couldn't find the good stuff before, because you would only get what you were fed.
That's right.
Yeah. So, but so it's somewhat back more, where we started.
Somewhat more egalitarian, hopefully.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Now, I wanted to ask you, and you kind of answered it, like, what made you, because you were doing very well in Great Speckled Bird, right?
Yes.
What made you break free and be a solo artist?
Well, I didn't go directly to being a solo artist. I joined a band that was kind of anarchistic, and it was called the Rhythm Rockets. And we knew that the name was ridiculous. I mean, we knew it at the time. We did that. We ordered pizzas from the stage. We told club owners to fire us. I mean, you know, it was just really...
Performance art.
Great, performance art, exactly. Yeah. And the quality level, I think, went wildly up and down. But I did that for a while. But mainly, the reason I left Dean and Sylvia was that I had... Okay, I never played the electric guitar before I joined them, right? Only acoustic.
That is wild.
And I'd gotten an electric guitar on a pawn ticket, right? And when I heard they needed a guitar player, I sort of begged them for an audition and got it, and somehow got the job. You know, I didn't know how to turn the amp on in their basement, you know, but I got the job. And replaced a wonderful guitarist named Amos Garrett, which was terrifying, you know. But I, anyway, so I did that for 2.5 years, and then I was really getting into the electric guitar, and I wanted to solo longer, because most of the solos there would be 8 bars, you know, 4 bars, quick turnarounds, which is fine, you know. But I wanted to do something where I could branch out more and stretch out more, you know.
And you replaced Amos Garrett, who was a pretty... big deal at the time.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Oh, very, very respected guitarist, and still is.
Yeah.
And that was terrifying. That was really hard. But the other hard thing that happened was that the steel guitar player in the band, not in the beginning, but a little while after I joined, was Ben Keith, who was Neil Young's band leader.
And
it was a magnificent player. Tone to die. Ideas so simple, just a great musician, right? And so there I am with my little Telecaster, and I play 8 bars, and then there's 8 bars of angel choirs, or vice versa.
Right.
And it was terrifying,
right.
You know, but it was, they didn't fire me, and it made me a better player to play with Ben, but it was very, very hard, you know.
What made you stay away from the electric guitar that long?
Partly snobbery.
This is like mid-70s, right?
Late 60s, around 1970. Late 60s. Yeah, a little earlier than that. I joined them in 1970, and I was a purist. I was into roots music. And, quick story, okay.
Yeah.
So I'm into roots music. Blind Lemon Jefferson, Robert Johnson, this is music to me, and everything else is crap. You know, that's how I thought.
Right.
So my mother announces to me one day, I have a sister who's 3 years younger. My mother announces to me, you're going to take your sister to the CNE to see the Jackson 5. And I thought, oh, no. Teeny bopper, bubblegum, crap, no. But I couldn't refuse.
Yeah.
You know, so I took my sister to the CNE, opening act plays. I'm not particularly impressed one way or another. And then out came a genius.
So you acknowledge that?
Yes, I saw Michael Jackson.
But you acknowledged it then?
No. Yes, after that night I did.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, he just tore me apart.
Right.
And there's this little kid up there holding the audience in the palm of his hand, singing and dancing like the genius he was. And that was an eye-opener, you know.
Did you end up buying some Jackson 5 records after
that?
No,
but I listened more to rhythm and blues, after that,
with more
respect, you know. Yeah.
I like that you held on so strongly for so long onto your acoustic guitar.
Well, it was like my secret. I had a couple of friends who were into it too, the secret world of that kind of blues, and I was really into it, you know. Yeah.
It wasn't as well known around that time?
No,
like
not at all.
Blues guys?
Not at all. I mean, there was a club in Toronto at Huron and Harvard, Howard's Campus Kibitzeria. That was the name.
Okay.
And it was owned by Howard Matthews, who was one of the people who owned the Underground Railroad restaurant, which was one of the only African-Canadian restaurants at that time in Toronto.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
And they would bring in blues singers who had recorded in the 1920s and 30s. And I had a friend, Harry, and Harry and I would go down and we'd see Booker White, who eventually asked me to play on stage with him, which was one of the great honors of my life. Yeah.
Wow.
And who taught me a lot about music, but about attitude too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I played for him the first time and played like some records, blues records and that. And he said, I can't play like Robert Johnson. And he said, but get your own, boy.
Wow.
Get something of your own. And that was great advice.
Mm.
You know? Yeah.
Wow. I have the complete opposite way of thinking. I was only about the electric guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And the acoustic guitar, I poo-pooed it, but mainly because it intimidated and it still does to this day, intimidated the hell out of me. Because every time I pick it up, I realized just how many more lessons I need on a guitar.
Well, you know.
Because, you know, it really, you have to tame it. But it usually ends up taming me.
That's right.
It's definitely a beast. An electric guitar, you definitely have more power and control over, or you can fudge your way through it and seem like you do.
There's a lot of room to fudge.
Yeah.
What I find with the electric guitar is it's very much a found experience in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Because what the amp does and the way it sounds will change with the venue, with mm-hmm. the temperature, with the humidity, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The nature of the electrical power, if it's good or clean or dirty. But with the acoustic guitar, basically, it sounds one way more or less.
Right.
And can be mic'd on that basis, you know.
So you go electric,
yes,
so to speak, right?
Yes.
When you break free, you're now fully electric.
Well, at the time, yes.
You were introduced to a mass crowd audience as an electric guitarist.
Yes, like Carnegie Hall. I mean, there I am, you know.
You feel like a traitor in some respect? Like you've kind of...
Not after I started playing, because I realized it took a lot more ability than I thought it did.
Okay, you just mentioned Carnegie Hall. Can I ask you about that?
That was, well, I'll just be honest with you. That was a very special night for me, too, because I was a lousy student in high school. I was no athlete, right? And so there I am, and Ian and Sylvia started going on the road with me playing acoustic guitar, which I was very comfortable with.
Right.
You know, so they did it with the band for a while, and then Ian had a television show that would be the electric band, but then they'd go on the road with just Ian on guitar and myself, and maybe a bass player later on. So I can't remember if there was a bass Christ's prayer or not. But we went and played Carnegie Hall, and, well, I just had a really good night. You know, Danko, one of those magic nights where things work, and they applauded my solos and stuff like that. And so there I'm, like 21, 22 years old, and I just thought, I know I haven't made it, but there's a career for me in music. If I can do this at Carnegie Hall and get a decent reception, then there must be something. I can probably work. You know?
I always think of moments like that, like big, huge moments, personal moments, where it's just kind of like a checklist, and you put it in your back pocket, and you. I say to myself, look, if nobody can take that away from me.
Yeah.
No matter what happens or what I do or how much I screw up, at least I got that under my belt. So that was one of those moments.
A great validation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
You know, it was,
Did you guys tour North America?
North America we did.
You did that whole... So you had the whole North American experience.
Well, before... I don't know about the whole experience, but we'd play in the South, and we did the Johnny Cash show, which that was a really unusual experience. I don't like... to sound like I'm name-dropping here, but...
Okay, no, I love
the
I
other,
love
okay,
I
the
love
other
it.
Act on the Johnny Cash show was Stevie Wonder. Now, I still wasn't convinced about R&B, right? You know, I like... You know, I was a blues guy. So, okay... they came over and asked if they could borrow our bass amp before the show to rehearse with. And 21 years old, I don't know anything about protocol or professionalism. And I said, can I come with it?
Right.
And they said, okay. So I go, and there I am in a relatively small room with Stevie Wonder, who I never met. I mean, he was there, and I bet he was there, but and rehearsing. But the bass player, guitar player, a drummer, because Stevie was on clavinet, I think, and three women backup singers and a manager. And he was working up a tune. I don't remember what tune.
Okay, all right.
But it blew me away. I mean, to see him play like that, and also to watch his hands, because the piano players I'd seen, and I mean, I play a tiny bit of piano myself, very little, but the piano players I'd seen had learned the conventional method, where if you do a scale, you put your thumb under your hand to continue, right, and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Stevie Wonder plays like a person, like a person who was blind and learned, you know.
Yeah.
And so he will hit two keys with his thumb,
right,
and different,
right,
you know, the hands looked very different.
Cool.
I know, the way they worked, you know. But that really opened another world to me when I saw that, you know.
Do you have a Johnny Cash story from
that? But it's kind of funny. And well, anyway, I'm there, and the Johnny Cash show budget was 10 times at least the budget of Ian Tyson's show. And so I thought, well, I even see Johnny Cash, you know, I'm curious. And so I'm backstage, we just arrived at Ryman Auditorium, which is a historic place in Nashville. Hank Williams was there,
okay.
You know.
Okay.
And I'm at Ryman Auditorium, and I'm walking down a hallway looking for the washroom. And down the hallway from the other direction comes Johnny Cash. And we're alone in the hallway. And he says, hi. And I didn't say anything. I was too intimidated.
Right, right.
But that's my Johnny Cash story. It's not much, but that's it.
So, you know, I mean, that show didn't last for too long, right?
I don't know. I didn't watch it much. I think 2 or 3 years anyway.
So you kind of got in there.
Yeah. Well, he had Ian Sylvia on.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, wow. That's so cool.
Yeah.
So when you break out and you become a solo artist and you're, you know, an electric guitarist, solo artist,
mm-hmm.
The first album comes out in 77?
No, it was recorded in 78, but it took 2 years to sell it. Nobody would release it because that was disco time, right? Everything was disco. I tried and tried to sell it, and finally there was a fellow starting a small label who released it in 1980. And it sold better than people thought it would. I think it sold 25,000 copies or something, which for a new artist was pretty good. Then the label couldn't pay me. Now, they eventually settled with me, in fairness to them, years later. But they couldn't pay me, so I was off the label. But it had proven that our music could sell some vinyl records. And so a little while later, EMI signed me.
Right.
And I was on and off their label for 15 years.
And that came out 2 years after... They re-released it, right?
Yeah, well, they re-released it. But it was... Okay, recorded in 78, released in 1980, and EMI bought it when they signed me.
You're right. And then, what I'm leading to is, that's 4 years, right, of working the same record.
Yeah.
Right? Because then they had to, there was the re-release, and then you have to work it all over again.
Well, now, we didn't work it the second time. When EMI released it, we didn't promote it. No, they just released it as part of their catalog.
Oh, just in case you missed this.
Yes. I had recorded a new album by then.
Oh, okay. Cause, for them, those were long years.
Yeah.
I was just going to ask you, like, how did you get through those years? And I can, I'm assuming that, you know, being a new solo artist, you're kind of like chomping at the bit to like write songs and get songs. I'm sure you had a ton. And
it was precisely at this moment that I started experiencing technical problems, but engrossed in good conversation with David, didn't notice immediately. I lost about 50 minutes of our talk. I stopped, turned on my smartphone, which actually saved the day, and as you'll hear, it did a pretty good job of capturing the rest of our conversation. So, without further ado, here's the rest of my conversation with the one and only David Wilcox.
So we left that off with you, me asking you about breaking out into a solo artist, and... let's just pick up from where you were just about to. Where were we? Jesus.
We were talking about artists diversifying.
Yes.
Their music, or you know, our music, yours or mine, just growing in different directions and reflecting who we change into as we evolve as human beings.
And I had made a mention of your recent work.
Yes.
Being softer, and still working with the rest of your discography, at least to me as a listener and a longtime listener, and it still makes sense in the discography, sitting in the discography. I also made mention of you still haven't abandoned some of the harder moments and more gnarly kind of blues riff moments, and I asked you if you were going to continue with some of those hard the hard rocking ways, because as a musician, I'm a rocker.
Yeah,
I mean, that's where that's what got me to you. So I asked you about that, and then,
Yes. I'm very much so. I still have a bunch of rock material that we haven't recorded, and we play. You know, I'm on sabbatical right now for 2018.
Yes.
Which I do once in a while. But I'm also recording an acoustic album of songs that are meant to reflect the music I fell in love with as a teenager.
Right.
And I have, you know, I've written songs in the style a little bit of those artists.
Okay.
You know, to try and capture some of the feelings and the grooves I love about it, with something original in it, I hope.
Who would those artists be? Who would the styles be?
Well, Robert Johnson, okay. Blind Lemon Jefferson, Blind Willie Johnson, Blind Blake. Stony Plain Records has already released a track of my little Blind Blake tribute called Uptown Bump. It's a guitar solo. And so those kind of things, those kind of artists.
When I think of Robert Johnson, I think of those songs on those two records that I have of his music.
Yep.
And I think of how it was recorded. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when I think about people like Robert Johnson, I think of, and people who are influenced by him and some of his contemporaries.
Yes.
I think about the sound of the recordings and how important it is to add, it adds to the feel of the songs. Did you incorporate that in your kind of tribute to these artists as well? I'm thinking of like a one mic thing or you know what I mean? Like
I started with one mic,
right.
But then I asked, I have a technical guy who teaches me, and he suggested going to stereo, so I did. Okay. I've now have two mics and I'm working with that, you know, so I think more unconsciously than anything,
right.
I would reflect the sound of those records. Also, it's important to remember that Robert recorded later than a lot of them did. He used a mic. Some of them did not. They recorded right into a horn, which is the way recording was done for part of the 1920s.
Okay.
You know, so Robert's fidelity is considerably better than an artist like Charlie Patton, who
right.
was a great genius, but didn't have the same freedom to engage in subtlety,
right.
you know, with the voice and guitar,
right.
the same way Robert would have because of the recording quality, you know?
Well, leading up to this, I it's not a, I mean, how many people has he influenced, but you've mentioned Elvis.
Mm-hmm.
Is there an Elvis thing in this?
Well, there always is, in a way, because Elvis was the first one who got me interested in music. I really liked the way that he upset grown-ups. When the Beatles came along, I'm old enough to remember both of these. Now, when the Beatles came along, grown-ups thought they were foolish and had no talent. Mm-hmm. You know, these silly mop tops from Liverpool. When Elvis came along, which was earlier, the grown-ups wanted to kill him. Right. Because he, the sexual danger that he radiated, and the whole race thing that he was singing, you know, the African American music in that style, you know, and so I really liked the reaction to Elvis. And what did Elvis have? A guitar. So I bugged my family until they got me a guitar, and then I fell in love with that.
You know, the some of the irreverence that Elvis brought to music and stuff, and then you mentioned the Rhythm Rockets as well. Yes, and Rockets, but I also hear it in your lyrics, just a very humorous and lighthearted approach to some of these kind of like heavy, heavy blues riffs that you're playing. I always thought that that was an interesting juxtaposition, that you didn't shy away from just being fun and funny in a music that sometimes I think people take a little too seriously because, you know, it's got so much history behind it.
Well, it happens, but the thing is, I feel that the message of any great artist isn't copy me. It's be yourself. Who are you?
Right.
You know, Elvis, in other words, we've already got one. So I never tried to sound like Elvis, but I tried to reflect the sensibility and the attitude that I got from him. And I copied Robert Johnson note for note in the beginning, you know.
Right.
But I now try to just walk humbly in his attitude and learn. For some reason, I think of Robert Johnson perhaps as the first rock artist.
Right.
You know, he just came from a different place. And Bob Dylan, who was so influential as a songwriter, said that there were hundreds of lines he wouldn't have written if he hadn't heard Robert Johnson.
Right.
You know.
I know this is getting to be somewhat of an interview. I kind of thought it could be a chat, but I just so interested in what you've done and your music. I wanted to go back and talk about some of the records, mainly the periods between them.
Yes.
There's after, is it Breakfast at the Circus, and then the one after it in 89, there are marked spaces between albums. Now, is that due to record company shuffling, labels, etc., or is that you touring? What is that? Is it downtime? You mentioned you're on, you know, sabbatical.
Well, I became more and more able to just record when I had something to say. Because one of the things about major labels, to me, is that it's like being a laying hen. It's time for an egg. You know what I mean? And maybe you're ready to record and maybe you aren't, but you're going in the studio and, you know, coming out with an album. I can now, thank heaven, have the freedom to say, okay, it's time. I have something that I think is worthy of release,
right.
You know, which is a great freedom for an artist. As
it,
you know.
It is. Yeah, that's why I noticed that there was like 4 years, 5 years, 3 years between albums. Mm-hmm. And I'm in a world where it's like album tour, album tour. I've been on this cycle for close to 15 years. Mm-hmm. It's what I know. But I'm not at home writing songs.
Right.
I don't even touch the guitar if I don't have to.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we get the due date in the calendar, then I'll pick it up and start playing. I also feel that time away from the instrument builds up the creative juices.
I think so too, and it breaks down the patterns of what Miles Davis called the butter notes, the notes that one automatically goes to, you know, just out of habit or whatever.
Yeah.
But an English record executive said to me they had a consistent problem with bands if they released a record, okay, and the record did well, right? Time came for a second album. The bands had 20 or 25 years of life experience to put into the first album, and since that time had only seen hotel rooms, concerts, or clubs, or something like that, and travel, right? Nothing else, you know? And so they had very little to draw on for a second album, and he called it a syndrome or something like that.
Like the sophomore jinx?
Maybe. That may be part of the cause of it. You know,
the first album has all the best stuff written over years and years and years.
Yeah.
And that's something that I thought of too, going into our second album.
Mm-hmm.
But I quickly got over it because I liked to be into the cycle that I saw so many of my favorite bands doing too. They're like, mm-hmm. well, Motorhead's putting out an album every 2 years till it was done.
Yeah.
So that's where I drew inspiration from. I'm like, okay, well, we're just going to keep doing that. Mm-hmm. And there's been some negative, obviously, there's positive and negative with everything.
Sure.
But I do enjoy just churning it out.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, absolutely.
About the songwriting process?
Okay? Sure.
Do you find that the best ones come quickly?
Always.
That's what
Always.
I think. Some of my best songs are written in 10 minutes.
Always.
You know, boom. If it's a breech birth and you know, you get a really good idea for the chorus and maybe part of a verse and then nothing.
Yeah.
Then, you know, it will either come back or not.
And that's also happened where the chorus was amazing.
Yeah.
And it just didn't make the deadline for this album. And I put mm-hmm. it away and then brought it back out maybe two albums later.
Sure.
And then I'm thinking of one song in particular, and we made a video out of it. It ended up mm-hmm. being a single. And it's the only song we play off the album that it was on. And I played it today in practice. And
mm-hmm.
and that was something that was left over. And I also feel like when I'm writing stuff, trying to come up with riffs, I'm always looking for that 5 minute tune that can be written in 5 minutes.
Yes.
And sometimes if I'm laboring over a riff, I drop it
mm-hmm.
because it's not one of the, it's not meant to be one of those magic songs.
Yeah.
Sometimes
yeah.
it happens that way.
Yeah. Every once in a while I've gotten something pretty decent that took a while, but it's rare.
Yeah.
Usually if it's taking a long time,
We have $1 million riffs that were left on the shore
because
they couldn't find a sale.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
And I can't find what it wants to do.
Yeah.
Does it want to be an instrumental? Does it what? You know? Yeah, it's an interesting process, isn't it?
In that point, because, you know, we write together as a band.
Mm-hmm.
Do you write alone?
Usually, yeah. I have collaborated with varying results. I made a record with Colin Linden, and we co-wrote, and that was fun. You know, it seemed to work well.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah.
But sometimes I've co-written with somebody and didn't really sit well. Yeah.
Because that would be an instance where you just go, take the baton, run with it,
mm-hmm.
see where it takes you.
Yeah.
Those are interesting. It's interesting things that I can't really share with anybody. There isn't anybody who does this to the degree that you and I do, where we get into the minutiae of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting. I love hearing songwriting, like songwriting snippets of you know, just experience. But yeah, that's interesting. So you write alone.
Mm-hmm.
That takes of discipline to me.
Well, I think it does to some extent, but also I try not to have a process, because if I have a process, it will repeat. I will repeat myself more. But if I, you know, sometimes carry a notebook around and write down whatever thoughts come, you know, and hopefully look for lyrics there and maybe get the words first. Or a riff is always an inspiration, isn't it? It's just your fingers stumble on something.
The riffs don't happen if you don't pick up your guitar. Are you someone who plays guitar every day? You're into it. You watch TV with the guitar. One of those guys?
Not now. I go through different phases. When I was in my 20s playing with Ian and Sylvia, I had days where I woke up in the morning, played the guitar, went to an Ian and Sylvia rehearsal in the afternoon, played the guitar, and went out in the evening and sat in with some friends in a club. You know, just played at that time. Right now, I'm not playing so much. And it just goes through different phases, I think. Don't you find that? But you say you like to grind it out. So you're
I've never been like that. Uh-huh. I've never I have after practice, if I have to hold a guitar, I just my body shivers.
Mm-hmm.
But it's 'cause I don't consider myself a guitar player. That's not what I lead with.
Right.
I'm more of a singer.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that leads me to asking you about singing.
Mm-hmm.
You have a very distinct voice. And this morning I was listening to Metro Morning and they had Randy Bachman on.
Mm.
And I remember the first time I heard Randy Bachman on the CBC. I didn't know he sounded like that. And I thought, who is this guy who speaks so eloquently and has so many stories about bands?
like a personal, and then it ended with him with the bumper. It's the Randy Bachman show. And he had such a great voice. It leads me to think you have such a great speaking voice. And I'm thinking of that one track off 13 Songs where you talk.
Right.
You talk sing.
Yeah.
Rainy Night Saloon.
Rainy Night Saloon. Yes.
And so I thought about that, and I have you done anything outside of singing?
I tried voiceovers for a while.
Yeah, and that would make sense.
Well, I did, but I never got I got one gig as an evil Hungarian in a video game.
Really?
They said Hungarian. Now, if you're Hungarian, don't be offended by this. Right. That was the role that I was given. Right. You know, it's not stereotype anybody.
You didn't write the script.
You know, right. No, exactly. But I did. My grandfather came from Czechoslovakia. Okay. And so I did his accent like this with an evil laugh. Oh, now I'm going to get you. And all this. And I got the gig. But that was the only gig I got.
What game is that?
Oh, that's a good question. No, I don't remember.
Okay.
The one with the evil Hungarian in it.
I'll do a search.
But it did make me a better singer, because I realized, trying to read these little scripts that they gave me for the auditions or whatever, I did realize that there's so many ways to interpret a phrase, aren't there?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, what do you mean? What do you mean? What do you mean? You know, or whatever phrase.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, that can be done so many different ways. So it made me a better singer.
It can tie you up as well.
Sure.
It can. It's like having too many guitar pedals.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's why I only use an overdrive, because, please, the options, endless options, leave you stuck in the same spot.
I can see that, yeah. I use about six pedals, but the thing is I don't use them in rehearsal. I play strictly through the amp, right?
Whoa.
So when we go to the gig, I have these, they're like spices. You know,
right,
if I'm cooking,
right.
A little oregano, a little, you know,
right,
whatever.
Right.
You know.
Does that kind of surprise the bandmates, your bandmates?
No, they didn't expect it. But
okay,
they know now. But
yeah.
But I try to surprise them with where I use them. I mean, you know, like, don't use the, you know, the envelope filter in the same place on the same night or a different night, that sort of thing, you know.
Do you find, as the front man, do you often find yourself playing to the back of the room? Meaning, do you find yourself entertaining the crowd, but also equally entertaining your bandmates, your crew that sees you night in and night out, making sure that they're as entertained as the audience, seeing that they've seen and played it millions of times?
Try to. But there's one caveat there, and that is no in-jokes. Never, not ever, ever. The audience is in on everything.
Absolutely.
It's a party, and we're here, and you're part of it. And so I'm very careful with myself and with the other guys about that. But I try definitely to keep them interested. And it's one of the benefits of playing with a trio is that you can keep it a bit loose.
Yeah.
You know, with more pieces, more musicians, it's harder to go somewhere new, because you got to take four or five people with you.
Right.
And there's more chance for a fender bender, right?
Right.
You know, but with three people, it can get pretty interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, that's another thing that you and I have in common is fronting, being the singer and having to hold an audience with your voice. And I started off saying that you have such a great speaking voice, something that obviously you were told before, because you did venture into voiceovers. Someone must have told you that. Nothing past that.
Not really.
No.
I mean, I don't know. Maybe I just didn't find my niche or something
like that. Right.
But, and I'm happy doing what I'm doing. So
nobody,
it wasn't like I feel deprived.
Nobody at the CBC has ever like come up to you and gone, David, you need, your voice needs to be on the air.
Well, no. But,
no. I got to put that out into the universe here.
Well, you know, I'm a happy person where I am. But if some opportunity came along, I'm always open to trying something new.
Yeah, I think that, you know, Randy, he's got that kind of cornered at the moment.
Sure.
But, you know, with your extensive experience and your music knowledge that you can bring, all the music history that you bring with your music, I can hear your voice fronting a nighttime kind of like, you know, like a down and cool and nighttime. Yeah, I can hear it.
I'll have to think about that.
Yeah, think about it. Let me put that in your ear and let me put that out into the universe.
Great.
It'd be great. So, that's very surprising that there hasn't been any more forays into anything past the music. But we've been talking about you as a guitarist and everything, mm-hmm. but you're also a vocalist. And yeah. I see myself as a vocalist first, mm-hmm. mainly because I consider myself a better singer than a guitarist. Mm-hmm. I'm like a glorified rhythm guitar player who got some sort of promotion due to just their lack of any options. Because we're a trio.
A good rhythm player is a really wonderful thing.
Sure, know? Yeah. But sometimes in the song calls for a solo, mm-hmm. and I am sweating bullets the night before I got to lay it down.
Really?
Coming up with just the simplest boxed solos. Mm-hmm. What do you consider yourself, first and foremost? What would you lead with?
Probably an entertainer.
Scratch that. I consider myself a performer, first and foremost.
Yeah, exactly. One of my heroes is Louis Armstrong,
right?
Who was such a marvelous. I mean, he really was one of the inventors of recorded jazz in the 1920s. But people don't think of him that way.
No.
They think of him as
Hello
Satchmo
Dolly.
Pops,
yeah,
Hello
yeah.
Dolly. You know, so an entertainer first, perhaps, and just a combination of all that. Because I feel like I'm not the best at any of it, but I'm an individual, and the combination probably is somewhat individual or even unique, as you have your unique skills, and that's what I think people are hopefully come to see.
If someone was to walk into our dressing room while we were on tour, they would immediately think I was a diva, that I've got a scarf on, I don't want to talk, all to do with the voice. Mm. And everybody in our entourage and our crew, they understand. They know where I'm coming from when I go, oh, we got to like turn up the heat. It's like, blah. Are you like that?
I'm very careful about it. It's funny, I remember the first time I ever met Carol Pope. We were introduced by a bouncer, right? Okay. And he said, I'm just getting over a cold. And Carol and I both leapt back 10 feet.
Yeah.
Because you know you can't sing with a cold,
yeah.
You know? And so, yes, I'm very protective of it. Yeah.
Don't think that when you said you were just getting over a cold half an hour ago, I didn't think, is he still contagious myself? And you said that. And I know being a singer, you had to say that.
Yeah.
It's something that I think no one understands. There was one time we just finished recording with Garth Richardson,
mm-hmm.
who told me to tell you to say, as he says, hi.
Oh, great.
Because, yeah, you guys worked together in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And leading up to the recording, I knew that, you know, I'd have to lay down some vocals. So mm-hmm. I was out on a Friday or Saturday night in Toronto,
mm-hmm.
before the session in Vancouver,
yes.
at a Japanese restaurant. We were seated right by the sushi chef. He started coughing.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That's what you want.
And then I looked over, and he wiped his nose with his hand. We left the restaurant.
Good for you.
Yeah, we had to.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But anyone else wouldn't even think that deeply about it.
Probably
and
not.
That's something. And then you get tagged with being a weirdo.
Oh yeah. Let me ask you this: have you ever had musicians try to persuade you to sing in a key that wasn't the best one because it's easier on the instruments? Like in other words, we can play this in E and it's a lot easier. But wait a minute, I sing it in E flat, or I sing it in F because you can't put a capo on the human throat.
Right.
You know what I mean? I think that the voice should always determine the key, even if the instruments have to work around it.
It took years, but now we tune a half step down.
So do we.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It took a long time to get that down. I didn't know how to solve this problem.
Mm-hmm. I think that's an essential thing.
Yeah.
You know, Hendrix tuned down a half step too, apparently.
That's good to know. It's good fuel.
Yeah.
So we will never tune back up. Because of, like, I just have to throw Hendrix's name in the pot, and it's like, oh, okay, so we will do that from now on.
Yeah.
So that leads me to this sabbatical that you're on currently. I just want to say thank you for doing this, because Jane told me that no interviews, no shows from December 31st of last year throughout this year.
Yeah. Well, I've done this before, and people misunderstand it because they think of it as a vacation, which it's not.
Okay.
It's a chance for me to grow, to learn, to listen, to improve my musical skills, to come up with hopefully new ideas, listen to some jazz, play a little jazz, ragtime, classical, whatever invites, and that way expand myself and deepen myself as a musician.
So you're spending your days this year doing just that?
Well, yes, but in a broader sense. You know, I was going to say to you earlier that I think one of the least understood aspects of our craft is the need that we have as artists to listen to this. The sound right now of life, of talking to a loved one, of dealing with some situation or an unexpected joy or tragedy or something like that. All the stuff that feeds our music and our art. You know, we need to absorb and nourish and let the field lie fallow a little bit, you know?
So I am someone at home who puts on a record in the living room, mm-hmm. walks to my bedroom, turns on my iTunes, different album.
Yes.
I have multiple albums playing. Nobody knows this about me if they don't live with me, mm-hmm. not even my bandmates, but I have multiple albums playing at home constantly. You're talking about silence, right?
Well, the silence in a way, but I mean, life makes sound, you know? And it's just more absorption than anything else. You know, maybe I'm listening to something, maybe I'm not.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And I definitely listen to my iPod at least once a day. Just a broad variety. Handel's Messiah.
Yeah.
A blues record, an old pop hit, whatever. Mm-hmm. You know? And just absorb.
Do you keep up with contemporary music?
Not that much. You know, Jesse Reyes has that wonderful song, Gatekeeper. Ooh, that's a good song. And I like Ed Sheeran, you know, Lady Gaga, you know. So I pay attention to some of it, but not much.
Right.
You know, just whatever calls to me, you know. Toronto has a funny history with the guitar, you know. I mean, Prince's guitar player, Donna,
Absolutely.
So many great guitar players, you know, you could make a list. I mean, well, in no particular order, Lenny Bro, Robbie Robertson, my favorite, Sonny Greenwich, who was from Montreal, but jazz player, you know, wonderful guitarist, Amos Garrett.
Mm-hmm.
So it's Toronto has a relationship with the guitar.
And the last thing that was released with your name attached to it mm-hmm. was Guitar Heroes.
Yes.
Which, if it wasn't said before, kind of instated you as a guitar hero. I mean, I think a lot of people who know you already consider you that. But it's nice to have it like kind of written in stone in a way, alongside all those other three guitar players: Albert Lee, Amos Garrett. You were saying, and
Mr. Burton,
right?
I've followed him since I was about 11 years old. He was on a TV show called The Ricky Nelson Show. He played some beautiful solos with Ricky Nelson, and then of course with Elvis. And he was, when I got an electric guitar and played with Ian and Sylvia, I tried to copy James Burton more than anybody. And I got to tell him that.
Did you guys play, is that Guitar Heroes, that's a night.
Yes. A
right?
concert in BC, I think in 2013, I'm not sure. But a rhythm section, Albert Lee's rhythm section, and the four of us. And we took turns, you know, playing solos.
That's incredible. I mean, I think a lot of people are doing that now in different fields of guitar music, where they're going out on tour and together three. I've seen that before.
Mm-hmm.
Are you guys going to do that again? Is that going to be something, or with another ensemble of guitarists?
Well, I'm open to anything, but I don't think the four of us will get together again. I doubt it.
Wow.
But anything's possible.
Yeah.
But it was very humbling to play with James Burton. He was
a
beautiful
imagine.
Player. I mean,
right.
just a really fine musician.
So you held your own. As a
well,
peer?
I don't know. I mean, they didn't fire me.
Well, they put it on record, right?
They did. So, they put it on a record.
They didn't erase it.
You know, well, I brought something different to it, I think. I brought a bluesier feel because the material I played was a bit different than theirs, which, especially Albert's, which tended to be very up-tempo.
Right.
And I actually soloed Danko at like super fast.
Keeping
I mean, when I can't
him?
Do
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah.
I, you know, but I thought it's the only chance I'll ever get to play Country Boy, which is this extremely fast song with Albert Lee. And I can either say yes or no, and I said yes to soloing. So, you know, I took the leap.
You gotta do. Yeah, once.
You know why not? Yeah. You know, and I went places I would not have gone otherwise. You know.
Did they play one of your tunes that
yes.
night?
Yes. No, we did Bad Apple, and I also did a couple of. I did Flip Flop and Fly, which is a sort of a blues standard, and another one called You're the One Who Really Gave Me a Buzz, which is by Jimmy Rogers, who was in Muddy Waters Band in Chicago.
Wow.
Yeah. So I sang a bit, and you know, we took turns.
That's amazing, and the fact that it's now released, mm-hmm. The Night was released as a full record, is you must consider that to be very satisfying.
Well, I'm honored. I'm very grateful to be part of it. Yeah, absolutely. You know.
Well, I mean, I think I picked your brain enough. We could keep going, but this has been amazing, David. Thank you so much for doing this.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed it, and it's really made my sabbatical better.
Great!
Just to do this,
it was fabulous.
Oh, great! I'm so glad. I really enjoyed myself.
Thank you.
$10 wristwatch on my wrist, $1,000 wrist and